check.
Oh, nice. All right. So, do you guys mind reading all that again? No? Okay. Okay. Colson, welcome. Glad you're here. I hope you guys find a little bit of what I found here. The Hawaiian word aloha, the best definition I've ever heard of it is the God in me greets or recognizes the God in you. And I think that's such a beautiful definition of this program. One person's higher power connecting with the higher power in the next person. Why am I defining a Hawaiian word? That'll make sense in a second. Let's see. My sobriety date is November 21st, 2016. And my home group is the Quartz Hill AM Attitude Modification that meets every day at 6:30 in the morning, Quartz Hill at the Grange Hall. Come by. We'd love to see you there. Birthdays are on Saturdays. I have to go back a little farther to explain how I got here. I'm a craft beer drinker through and through, but my very first drink was wine, and my very last drink was wine. And it was awful cheap wine. It was horrible. The depths of insanity, right? But I was born to an American mother in Germany and a German man. They divorced when I was one, not in any small part to my mother's alcoholism. And she and I moved to her parents in Hawaii. Ah, told you. So I spent my time bouncing back and forth between my mother's family in Hawaii and my father's family in Germany. And no matter where I was, I never fit in. I never felt like I fit in. In Hawaii, I was the skinny little white kid. And in Germany, I was the American who didn't speak German very well. And that became kind of the story of my life. I never felt like I fit in anywhere. My mother got sober there. In fact, she celebrated 48 years of sobriety this past year. No thanks to me. And I remember her taking me to AA meetings when I was young, and eventually I asked her to stop taking me because I didn't like how they talked and they cussed a lot and they were mean. Growing up in Hawaii in the 70s and 80s was an experience. But at some point, when I was probably in the 6th or 7th grade, they put me into Catholic school, a Catholic private school. And I met this guy there. He's my oldest friend today, Roger. And he said, you know what we should do? We should go be altar boys at Mass. And I said, Roger, I'm not a Catholic. It doesn't matter. They need help. They need some people. And it'll get us out of class. I said, okay. Sounds like a plan to me. Get me out of class. So they dress us up. And we go to do our first Mass, and I'm up there on stage in front of the whole school, and the priests are in their stuff, and they come around, and they're handing this goblet around. And they get to me, and I'm like, I kind of look at my buddy, and he's like, yeah. So I take my first drink of wine, and it kind of burns going down, and I turn to Roger, and I go, I feel the Holy Spirit, like, going all the way down. Yeah. Maybe I am Catholic, after all. And as I stood up there in front of the school, I felt an ease and comfort. I almost felt like I fit in. All of a sudden, whatever nervousness I might have had up there, or fear, my whole life was run by fear, it wasn't gone, but it was mitigated. It was tamped down by that drink. And that stuck so vividly in my mind. But I didn't really start drinking until a few years later. in high school, I always kind of seemed to be the one who would go a little too far. Like I said, I was going back and forth between Hawaii and Germany. And in Germany, I had my first experience with blacking out when I woke up one day and my mother-in-law was furious. She asked what had happened the night before, and I said, "What do you mean?" And she told me about all the vomit she cleaned up in the bathroom. I have no idea how it got there. I do know that the dog never always growled at me from then on, and I don't know why. So I had never made amends to that dog. He's passed on. But it was I began to get an inkling that something might be a little different with me compared to my friends. They didn't seem to have those kind of stories. When I got back to I went to college in Germany and came back here and finished a degree here. I moved to LA and continued that process of always being a little bit more in trouble, a little more drunk than everybody around me, but it really didn't seem to be a problem. It worked great for me as far as feeling like I fit in with the people I was around. And then when I moved here to LA, I had a few friends who moved here with me, and we were working in the entertainment industry, and one night, one of them got a DUI. And I thought it would be really funny as like a consolation gift to go and get him a homebrew kit so he could learn how to brew his own beer. I don't know why I thought that was funny. So we went here to the Woodland Hill, it's Woodland Hills Home Wine and Cheese Making Shop. And while I was getting him his kit, I thought, you know, I could probably save a lot of money if I just learned to brew beer too. Because I'm really smart. So I got myself a kit and I started brewing beer. And it was awful. But it got better. And I took a few bottles of it to some competition at the Renaissance Fair. And they placed really well. And I thought, man, I'm amazing. I found out later that there were only like 17 entries in the whole competition. But I thought, I should start doing this beer brewing thing. This is great. And so I did. I went as hardcore as I could into it. I started teaching home brewing on the side. I still had a day job that I was beginning to neglect more and more, because I got this other job, a side job, with a company that was broadcasting live beer events and teaching brewing around the world. And I thought, well, this is a cool deal, because now I have a hobby that gives me something that I need to go do out in the garage, you know, by myself. And then this company, little hobby thing, they're willing to fly me places to teach people how to brew, and they're going to give me free beer. This is genius, like I said. So I'm going to try to keep it on time, Sandy.
You can go over it.
I won't. So nonetheless, as I should also let you know that around this time, I met a wonderful lady, got married, and we had two kids. So now I'm not the single guy who's going off into the garage to brew beer, right? I'm a married man with toddlers. And I started that ease and comfort that I was getting from those first drinks became a requirement, a daily requirement. And when you brew your own beer, at first it's really fun. Then it kind of becomes work. And then if you're an alcoholic like me, it becomes impossible to keep up. You really can't. So I'm working for these breweries, helping them, and they offer to pay me in kegs. So I pretended to think about it. And I said, sure, we can do that. I set up a kegerator in the garage, but I quickly found out that that wasn't going to work because they need those kegs back. You have to return them, right? And I was finishing them too quickly. I couldn't bring the keg back, you know, 3 or 4 days later and say, it's empty. Here you go. So I had to start stacking kegs in the garage to return later so they wouldn't know how fast I was drinking them. Or I just have to pretend I was having constant parties that I wasn't having. And slowly, my wife and kids began to notice that something was up. I had these little kind of get-out-of-jail-free cards in my mind, you know, that I could play. Like the time my wife came to me and said, I'm getting really concerned about your drinking. And I said, you know, yeah, I'm drinking too much beer. I'm going to switch to gin. Because it's more expensive and it's fancier, I won't drink as much. A few months later, she came to me with the same concern. And so I said, I'll pour it out. I don't need it. And so I poured out a big bottle of Bombay Sapphire. And see, I don't need this. There went another get-out-of-jail-free card. And slowly I was beginning to use those cards up. My drinking was affecting work. It was certainly affecting my hobbies. It was definitely affecting my family. I drove drunk with my kids in the car every single day. There was the time where I thought it would be funny after a rainstorm to peel out. I ended up spinning the car around with both kids screaming in the back seat. Blew out the back tire, and slammed into the curb. I don't know how I got out of that one. I went to go change the tire, thinking I'd get us home somehow, quickly. And a guy pulls up alongside on the street, rolls his window down, and I'm all ready to tell him, no, I'm good, don't worry. He leans out and said, sorry, buddy, I called the cops. And I was like, oh, what a dick. So now I really need to get this tire changed and get home. Get out of there, right? And I was so drunk, I couldn't remember. I've changed so many tires in my... When you grow up on Maui, you change tires all the time. Because you're off on dirt roads and running through cane fields. I've changed tires. But I was incapable of changing a tire. I was so drunk, I couldn't remember which thing went where. I was missing a piece of the jack. It was all right there. I just couldn't see it. So somehow, the AAA guy shows up and gets me going, and we get home before the cops show up. I don't know how. I didn't deserve it. I deserved a DUI almost every day for 6 years. Then, in the last year of my drinking, in 2016... Things were really getting, it was getting impossible to ignore. My sister came to visit from Germany, my half-sister came to visit, and I just about ruined every day of her trip. I didn't mean to. I kept wanting not to drink. I never understood why it seemed so easy in the morning to be like, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink. I don't even have anything. I'm not going to drink. And somehow, by 9 or 10 in the morning, there'd be some reason I had to run to the store. And if there weren't, I'd invent one to run to the store and come back with a couple 12-packs. And then no matter what, once I'd started, I couldn't stop. There was no stopping until it was all gone. I wasn't one of those guys who had beer left in the fridge the next day. Almost never. And it made no sense to me because the results were getting terrible. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd lie there in bed and think, oh good, I didn't get drunk last night. Wait, how'd I get to bed? And then, wait, how did I get home? And I'd start to piece the night back together to what do I remember? And then I'd check my phone and see the social media posts I needed to delete. And it would start all over again the next day. that last year also, my kids were in middle school. And there was a PTA event. My wife was at work, and so I was the one to take them. Oh, thank you. And so I was the one to take them to that event. So I had my requisite drinks before going. And it was kind of one of those things where you get there and they're going to do, all the parents are going to meet all the teachers. So you've got 5 or 10 minutes of each period. And as parents, you're going around to the rooms to meet the teachers of your kids. And the kids were off helping somewhere. Well, by the time I got to the third period, my buzz was wearing off. So my solution was to excuse myself, jump in the car, run home, have a couple more beers, and come back. And, you know, they were so stupid, they couldn't even tell I'd been drinking. I'm sure they couldn't smell it. And I'm greeting teachers and shaking hands and just being the best dad. And my kids come run up and say, "Dad, where were you? You missed so-and-so." I said, "Oh, I just had to go to the bathroom." Don't ask me about the rest of that night because I don't know. It was just another blackout. I told you I got sober in November. October is a busy month in our house. It's my wedding anniversary, my kids' birthdays, my wife's birthday. And I remember none of it that year. I know about Halloween because there's a picture of me taking the kids trick-or-treating. I have no memory of that. I do remember getting kind of upset at some point during Halloween because my beers kept disappearing. And then at one point, my wife comes to me mad and says, "Why are there 5 bottles of beer out by the trash cans?" And I was like, "You found my beer! Thank you! I'm almost out!" And I ran out there and got to drink some of those half-empties. I still wasn't sure I had a problem. I still wasn't convinced. A few weeks later, I had tried several times to use one of those get-out-of-jail-free cards to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic. That word didn't even enter my vocabulary, to prove I didn't have a drinking problem. I'd go a couple days here and there. See? I don't need to drink. I made it 12 days once on a family trip down to Disneyland, which was like a record. I thought, my God, I deserve a reward for that. And I did. But on this second or third weekend in that November, we had a house guest staying over, and I thought, man, I got to be good. I can't drink. And on that Sunday, my wife, kids, and this house guest went to one of the kids' weekly dance classes. So they're off to the ballet class, and I'm sitting there at home. I don't have a car, because one of the cars was in the shop at the time. And that resolve not to drink disappeared almost the instant they were out of the driveway. And I'm like, man, because I'm an opportunistic drinker. If you gave me the opportunity, I'd find something to do. I'd find a way to drink. And I did that day. I called a cab, ran to the store, got some of the highest alcohol beer. Got the highest alcohol beer they had. Because, you know, craft beer, I have standards. And I got home and drank all that, and that was out, and they weren't back yet, and I wasn't done. So I started looking through the kitchen, and I found this bottle of cheap cooking wine. That's the cheap wine. And by the time they got home, the beer was gone, all the wine was gone, and I'd stuffed it pretty far down the trash, but they found it anyway. And I was in a blackout. So I don't really know what happened that night. I woke up the next morning in bed. Oh, thank God I didn't get drunk last night. My wife was really quiet the next morning. So I was like, okay, I'll just be cool. And we go to get the car that I told you about was in the shop. And so we're driving there. And she says, "So, last night was weird. And I said, yeah. And she said, yeah, let's never do that again. And so I had one get-out-of-jail card, I thought, left to play. You know, I thought, oh. I said, I guess I better go to one of those AA meetings. And she said, yeah. And I said, okay. So it seemed to diffuse, and I was like, okay, maybe I'm okay. I'll just go to a couple of these meetings. It'll be no big deal. I was pretty convinced I had some kind of a problem, but I was not convinced I was never going to get to drink again. So I got online and tried to find a meeting that was convenient for me and for the family. And it was at 6:30 in the morning in Quartz Hill, California. And I drove over there the next day, and I sat in the parking lot in front of that meeting hall, and man, I did not want to go in. I sat and watched the people walking up, and none of them looked like me, and none of them looked like how I want to look. They're all weird. And I sat in that car watching the minutes tick closer to when the meeting was supposed to start, and I didn't want to go in. What I didn't know was some of the best friends I'd ever have in my life were sitting in that room. I just hadn't met them yet. And so as 6:30 rolled around, I walked in. And I sat down close to the door. And I can't tell you much about that first meeting. I think the guy leading it was named Victor. But I'm not sure about that. Can't tell you anything that was said in the meeting. But I picked up another get-out-of-jail-free card at that meeting. Someone said, try coming to a meeting a day for 3 months. Try to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And my first thought was, are you nuts? 90 days? But I thought, oh, wait a minute. I'll tell my wife that that's what I'm going to do, and that'll be kind of my ticket to peace and calmness at home. So I started to do that, and I wasn't convinced I was an alcoholic. People were telling stories in that meeting every morning, and one or two might have crept through a little bit. They were all very nice. But something happened a week and a half in, 10 days in. I have to tell you about Big Mike. Not to tell you his story, but he's a huge part of my story, so I got to tell you. Big Mike was an asshole. He was so angry. He had had a DUI, and it had gone horrible. I forgive me for not knowing the exact details. That period of time is a little murky for me in that first week and a half. But he was mad. And somehow he always sat next to me. Like, I felt like he was seeking me out, this guy. And like, he would stop me in the parking lot and go, did you ever drive drunk? Hammering his big, he's huge. He was huge. And I'm like, yeah, I did. He goes, you're lucky. Nothing happened to you. And I was like, oh my God. I'm just trying to get out of jail free card here. And I wasn't feeling like I fit in at all, really. But he was so angry, and every time I'd sit down and he'd be there, and there were days I was like waiting to see where he was going to sit so I could go sit somewhere else, and he'd move. And then, like I said, 10 days in, I get to the meeting and he's not there. And I'm like, yes. And then I found out that the day before, Big Mike... He went out, and he saw no other solution anymore. And he drove his truck out into the desert and poured gasoline on himself and set himself on fire. And that was the day I became an alcoholic. Because I realized, looking back at my story, all the times that all I wanted to do was to segregate myself from my family, from my friends, from work. And I saw that my disease wanted to get me alone so it could kill me. Thank you for the poignant phone drop. That was perfect. Perfect. I became convinced that this thing wants to get me alone to kill me. And I got serious. I finally got serious about attending those meetings, and I started to pay attention to what people were actually saying. I heard someone say, get a sponsor. So I started looking around the rooms, and I met a wonderful man named Jeff who had something I wanted. He was calm in the face of criticism and the whirling chaos around me. He was calm and peaceful, and I'm like, how do you get that? And they said, well, you might try doing the 12 steps on the wall. You might try that. And so I went to him, and it's such a beautiful part of our program that we get to humble ourselves and ask for help. I am not good at asking for help. But I got to go to him and ask him if he would take me through those steps, and he did, with kindness and grace and patience for my nonsense. We got to that fourth step, and I got to see that I'm full of pride and ego, selfish and self-centered, have a gigantic fear of failure. And as we went through those steps, and things began to fall away and fall off, and I began to feel lighter, something strange was happening at home. You know, I was learning a whole new language in AA, a new way of looking at life, new perspectives. But I was gone all the time to AA, which for my family wasn't that different from me being gone drinking. And as you do, AA wrapped its arms around us. And when I was 30 days sober, we were invited to a couples group for sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous and their partners, whether the partners are in the program or not. And so from 30 days on, for the last 6 years, my wife has gone on this journey with me in that group and gotten to know me and gotten to know AA, most importantly, gotten to know you. And it's been beautiful and fabulous. About that same time, not much longer than that, I get this call from my sister, the one whose vacation I ruined when she was out visiting at the end there of my drinking career. I get a call from her, and I know what the eighth step is going to be, and I know what the ninth step is going to be, and I've already, you know, projected ahead, because, and my sister calls me from Germany and says, I'm getting married in August, and I want you to come. Now, I'm newly sober, our finances are a mess, I'm like, congratulations on your engagement. I said, I don't think there's any way I'm going to be able to be there in August for your wedding. And she goes, oh, no, I don't want you to come. I want you all to come. I want all four of you to come. So then that's when I just laughed at her. And I told my sponsor about it. And he reminded me that, of course, I can't. Of course, I can't do that. But maybe there's a power greater than me that can if I'm willing. If I'm open to the idea. And that became one of the first miracles in this program for me. In the next few months, my work picked up, and we found some super cheap tickets online. And to make a long story short, all four of us ended up being there to see my sister get married in Germany. We had the worst, you know, plane ticket ever, 19-hour layover somewhere, but the price was right, and we had fun on that layover, so it was cool. But I got to be there, and then I got to make my ninth-step amends to her in person. Actually, on the evening of her wedding, which was not my choice, but that's how it worked out. And thank God I'm not directing things, because it was absolutely fantastic. And she was kind of confused. I kind of teared up, and I was figuring she would too. But she was kind of confused, like, what are you talking about, ruining my trip? I'm like, don't you remember how terrible I was? I think she was just being kind, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It was beautiful. And then I got to my first year of sobriety and took my cake, and our group, when you have a year of sobriety, it suggested you wait. at the end of the meeting, they ask if anyone's willing to be a sponsor to raise their hands. And so after that year, I raised my hand, and I did it every meeting I went to after that. And no one took me up on it. And so on my second birthday, I was sitting there, and life was pretty good at this point. Life was pretty good. Things were going okay. But I was starting to feel an emptiness, a sense of not fitting in again. And like always seems to happen in this program, the right person arrived in my life. A gentleman named John, at the end of one morning meeting, said, "Tomorrow is the H&I business meeting at 10:30 in the morning at such and such location. It just might keep you sober. Why don't you show up?" And he said that to the group, but I thought, oh, he was only talking to me. And so I went to that meeting. I didn't know what H&I was. I wasn't sure what was going on. But I got there, and halfway through the meeting, the leader said, "We need a panel leader for Acton for the men's side on Thursday nights," or something like that. That meant nothing to me. I didn't know what was going on, but I said, "I'll do it. I'll do it." And I went. So that was my first panel. And I discovered something in H&I that took my love for Alcoholics Anonymous, changed it, expanded it. When I go to those panels and I see there's a light, there's a difference in the room, I find, for me. When I'm in a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and there's one or two newcomers, versus when I'm in an H&I, a room of H&I, where it's all newcomers and one or two people on the panel. And I feel there's something magical in the air that is there, if I can remember to be honest. They told me there's a few things I need to remember to do. Number one, show up. Number two, pay attention. And number three, be honest. And then the last one is, don't get attached to the results. Stay out of the results. And so I fell in love with H&I. Unfortunately, this was shortly before COVID. So I got like a good year and a half of H&I and panels and all of that love in, and things changed. And that's okay. We continued on. That beloved facility in Acton closed for good so far, but others have opened up, and I've gotten to be of service in H&I ever since. I've been a part of our H&I committee since for 4 years now. This year we started a meeting at our local transitional housing for the homeless shelter in Lancaster, and that's been unbelievable. This past Wednesday, it's every Wednesday at 6:30. And we've had attendance somewhere between, 3 and 11 people. It seems like it's almost never the same residents who come. And and we usually bring a panel of 2, 3, 4 of us. And this past Wednesday, 3 days ago, I went and I was all alone. No one else could be there with me. And so I sat there, and I knew I was coming here today, so I had my book with me, and I was waiting for the meeting time to roll around. I opened my book and I just start reading. And a few minutes after 6:30, one guy walks in, an older gentleman, and he looks around. He goes, "No one else is here?" And I go, "No, man, you're it." And so he and I started a meeting. I told him a little bit about my story, and I realized this is going to be a really long meeting for this poor guy if we just read and talk about me. So I wrapped it up and started to just talk to him. And he starts crying. And we did the first, second, and third steps there that night. And it was beautiful. It was the higher power in me recognizing the higher power in him and just talking to each other. When we wrapped it up and we hugged, he said, "I'll be back next week." I said, "Okay, I'll see you then." Until then, there's other meetings you can go to. And I gave him a list. But I think he meant it. But whether he, coming back, I mean, but whether he did or he didn't, I am not attached to the results. That's up to my higher power. I'm sorry, Sandy, I've lost track of my timer. Oh my God, I really lost track of my timer, huh?
Okay.
Stay out of the results. I remember back when I was a kid and my mom was getting sober, I remember turning to her one day after asking her to please stop taking me to your AA meetings. I remember turning to her and saying, will I be an alcoholic, Mom? And she was quiet for a minute. And she said, I don't know. But if you are, you'll know where to go. I thought, today that sounds kind of wise. At the time I was like, where? But I was probably like 8. I didn't say that out loud. I didn't give her the opportunity to answer. But a few years ago, when I was in my first year of sobriety, one of my kids came to me and said and asked the exact same question. In fact, I had forgotten about my question to my mother until this happened. And my kid said, Dad, will I be an alcoholic? And that memory of my mom came rushing back, and I turned to her and said, I don't know. But if you are, you'll know where to go. And she nodded sagely. And I'm thinking, you don't know what I'm talking about, do you? But you know what? She does. She does know today. Because I'm a different dad than I was. We have a different marriage than we had. And I have a different relationship with my kids than I had. I'll tell you one more quick story before we wrap up. This program, getting sober in those first 30 days, it's everything. Because without that, nothing else happens, right? But then after a while, for me, when you go through the steps and you begin living these principles in your life, then you've got to kind of figure out a way to be a member of this society and this fellowship, to live your life sober. And this program gave me a shift in perspective. Like in Indiana Jones, when he's going across that huge chasm and there's nothing there, and he takes that step out. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? And there's that stone bridge that's painted to look just like the other side that he couldn't see, and he's able to walk across. It's that shift in perspective when it swings around and you realize there is something there that you didn't see, that you didn't know was there. That's what this program gives me. And the most recent example of this was almost exactly a year ago today. My wife and I were driving a car back from the mechanic. My wife was in the car that was just fixed, and I was in the one behind her. It was just like a simple maintenance of some kind. And someone plowed into my wife, totaled the car. And so once the immediate aftermath was dealt with, my wife was okay, and the car was hauled off, and the insurance was contacted, and all that sort of thing happened. My first reaction once I was out of there was very different from the reactions I had in the past to situations like that. Normally, I would run to the liquor store, get as drunk as I could, as fast as I could. But my reaction that day, my first thing I did was I called my sponsor, Jeff. And the second thing I did was I went to a meeting to talk about it. But that's not really the point of this story. To keep it as general as possible, the other party, to keep it as general as possible, we were found at fault for the accident. I may disagree with that finding, but that doesn't matter. We were found at fault. And so, not only were we down a car, but we were down a bunch of money. And so it was hitting me in my fear, right? My ego, my pride. But because of this program and a shift in perspective, it turned out to be an absolutely beautiful thing That's going to sound weird, or that probably does sound weird, but let me explain. When you're four people, four drivers, like we are in the house, and you only have one car, you're forced to align your schedule. You have to talk to each other. You have to plan your lives around each other. All of a sudden, I'm spending a lot more time with my kids in the car, driving back and forth and doing things. I'm talking with my wife about, why do we live so far from everything? Maybe we want to live in a town where it's closer, where we don't have to drive everywhere. My wife and kids start taking their bikes everywhere. My wife has biked to work every day for the past year and back. And it opened up a whole avenue of conversations that just didn't exist before the accident. I don't know where it's going to go. We haven't made any decisions. But my God kind of has a sense of humor, and I think maybe my God thinks I'm stupid because this experience that led me to acceptance needed to be hammered home a little more, and that's when the head gaskets on the second car blew a month later. So we're driving that second car, and you could go a few miles before it overheated, and but you know what? We had done everything that we could do. I did what you guys taught me. Do what's in front of you. Take the next indicated step. Do the right thing. Tell the truth. And that's what I did every step of the way. With that accident, with the car. I have to say this too. Dang it. When we went to go buy a new car, a used car to us, and I went to trade in the blown head gasket car, I didn't tell them about the blown head gaskets at first. And then I didn't sleep that night. And I think I talked to my sponsor about it. I did, right? Yeah. But I ended up notifying the people we were going to trade the car in with, the dealership, and said, there's something I got to tell you about this car. And I did. And God, I was sure I was going to ruin it, the deal. But it was fine. It was fine. Show up, pay attention, tell the truth, and don't get attached to the results. Because my higher power knows better than me. My higher power knows better than me what I can take, what I can handle, how things should go. All I can see is that there's this giant chasm that I can't walk across. But my higher power is over here saying, no, there's a bridge. I got you. Just show up. Thank you, Sandy, for having me here, for having us here this weekend. Thank you, other Sandy, for being such a gracious host. And thank you guys for letting me share.